Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Our guest today is Michael Hiltzik. He is the author of Golden State, The Making of California. Golden State is a fascinating survey of California, very much in the genre of Kevin Starr's work. Hiltzik is an American columnist. Hiltzik is a columnist, reporter, and has written extensively for the Los Angeles Times and published numerous books on California history. This was a fun and wide-ranging conversation, and I know you'll enjoy it. Let's go meet Michael Hiltzik. Michael, I want to start by talking about your favorite survey histories of California. Which big books about California figure prominently in your mind?
I'd say that the two that were most important, at least in my research, were a comprehensive one-volume history of California by Kevin Starr. And I think that was a digest of his seven or eight books of California history.
Can I interrupt you real quick? I get that question a lot, whether people should start with a single volume or go through the eight. And I always ask about their level of patience.
I think the issue that I had with the eight volumes was that Kevin took a digressive approach. He would start on a topic and then veer off into another topic. And he filled up a lot of books that way. But sometimes it was a little hard to follow. The one volume history is pretty concise. So
yeah,
I would say that's the one. And of course the place to start now is with my book, but
did you like Kevin's kind of intellectual approach to telling California's history? Do you think that is a good way to approach it?
Yeah, it was a historian's approach. When you contrast his approach to mine, basically I would spend sometimes a full chapter on events, episodes, personalities that he might devote a sentence or two to. I was really looking for a narrative thread in mine. And then I would say also the other comprehensive history that I relied on quite a bit was California, The Great Exception, which was by Cary McWilliams. McWilliams is really a monumental figure in terms of California historiography. The one drawback of his one volume book is that it was written in 1940. It didn't bring things up to date. And the conception of what California was all about, I think, has evolved since 1940. And you can see that in Cary's book. But Cary also wrote many other books, including a whole book about Southern California. His work was a great resource for me.
Yeah, I just actually picked up California Exception recently. I only read Factories in the Field, and so I started to expand my scope in his bibliography. Do you agree with his kind of general thesis statement in that book, or where do you differ from Cary and how he views California history?
I thought that, in fact, I think what I said in my book about it is that he was never quite clear about what California was the exception to.
Yeah.
But I think he did grasp the sort of exceptionalism of California. And that's something that we're seeing today in terms of this state's reaction to Trump policies and Gavin Newsom's reaction. It's California exceptionalism. It's a California sense of independence that I think McWilliams really had a good grasp of.
Okay. What do you think are the lacunae or gaps in our writing about California history? Are there periods of time or subjects in California's history where you wish there was a larger body of literature that maybe are underrepresented?
Where there were gaps, that was an opportunity for me to fill the gaps. And I tell people that what I tried to do when writing this book was to balance three categories of California history. And one is the stories that readers would expect to see in a book of California history. And that included the gold rush, the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, the Mission era, when the Spanish Franciscans really first arrived. And then there were stories that if you grew up in California, you would have a sense of, and maybe if you were in a California, you would have heard about, but not really know much about. And that included things like the Bear Flag Rebellion of 1846, and which is my favorite episode of California history, just because it was so wild and, in fact, almost comic. So things like that. I think the progressive revolution of the 1910s, this is something that I think people have a sense of, but don't really know much about. They know, if they're from California, they know that Hiram Johnson brought us the recall and the initiative and the referendum.
That's what I was
But
going to point to in your book, was really that section on the progressive period. I feel like maybe it's covered, but it's maybe the most misunderstood part of California history.
yes, one of many is that were misunderstood. And then I think people would be interested in knowing more about John Muir's role here and his relationship with the Yosemite, and also his ethos of conservatism, excuse me, conservationism, which was a radical thought of, and in his era, and became very controversial and actually resulted in his split with Theodore Roosevelt. And then the third category of things that I think people don't really know much about at all, and that would include the era of genocide against Native tribes, which I think people didn't really understand until fairly recently when there was great research. And then also, people don't understand much about the incarceration and relocation of the Japanese in 1942 and how that came about.
There's so much there. I want to ask you broadly what you think about the status of regional and state history as a subject matter. I work a lot in local historical societies and have my fair share of interactions with antiquarians and local history types. And it seems like state history is in this weird middle ground between these kind of national epics that we get, your Gordon Woods, and then you have these kind of local histories of families that a lot of the historical societies produce. What's your kind of broad thoughts on the status of state level history writing as it is today?
I grew up and was educated in New York State. And if growing up in New York, in school, you got a full dose of New York history. And of course, New York history is important because of the state and the city's role in the grand pageant of America. And I think California fills that same function. California is so big, so important, and its history is colorful and varied that I think as I saw, and as we can tell from Kevin and Carrie McWilliams, there's a lot to write about that will fill books. Other states, other regions, maybe not so much. I had a conversation with an editor of mine at the Los Angeles Times just recently, because she had asked for an essay about nonfiction about California, and she made a remark at one point saying, nobody really wants to know much about the history of Alabama or Arkansas, but they do want to know about the history of California, and it's part of California's general appeal to outsiders who are curious about the place.
Yeah, it feels like there's a few states that get some kind of privileged status. There's a lot of great state level history about Virginia, Massachusetts, New York, California. But I'm just as curious about the history of Alabama as any other state. I want to ask you a couple questions about your background as a columnist. What about being a columnist prepares you to write history?
It was really not just being a columnist, but having been a journalist and a journalist at the LA Times for more than 40 years, and a journalist more generally for more than 50 years, that attuned me to the importance and the technique of narrative history. We look for episodes, we look for events, we look for personalities who can help us define larger issues that we find important. And that's I think that's the approach that journalists who become historians tend to take. You want to have a narrative thread. You want to be able to illustrate what you're talking about as vividly as possible. And the way to do that is to take a sort of a journalistic view of things and a journalistic approach of looking for stories. I think that's certainly been my approach. This is my eighth book. It's an approach that I've taken in almost all of them.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about a few of your previous books here in a second, but I want to ask, like, how does the vantage point of working with LA Times. Do you think that affects the way California, in certain respect? How does it affect the way you write from that vantage point?
What's the vantage point of being at this point a Californian? I don't know that the vantage point of having worked at the LA Times specifically is has done as much as just being able to travel the state and to be attuned to what goes on here, the politics of it, the social environment, the economics of it, industry, what have you. These are all subjects that the LA Times has allowed me to delve into as deeply as possible. So I think the role of working at the LA Times is the opportunity it's given me to learn as much as I can. And then when I turn to either the history of California or the histories that I've written that have some nexus with California, basically that involves a whole new category of research and a different process. But what I've learned as a reporter and columnist at the LA Times is really helps me to do the research that I needed to do to complete the picture.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about this next subject. If there's something I love as much as history is food, and the LA Times had one of the greatest food writers ever in Jonathan Gold, do you think we'll ever have someone so idiosyncratic, so interesting, so attuned to the street level politics of food as Jonathan Gold? And do you have any interactions with him that you could share? He's just a
Well,
personal hero of mine.
I did know Jonathan pretty well, though I never got invited by him to join him on a visit to a
Oh,
restaurant or
man.
a truck or anything. Jonathan was unique, really. And I think when he basically started to write about ethnic food and ethnic communities through their food, that was something that I think taught the food critic community something that they didn't really grasp. So I think we see food writers all over the country, really all over the world, taking a sort of Goldian approach to their work that didn't exist as much, very notably, before he started.
Yeah, he definitely enticed me to comb through strip malls that I'd never consider. And so I found myself in some Lao restaurants I didn't know exist because I just was wandering through a strip mall. And so there's so many ways I appreciate him. Let's talk about a couple of your previous books. And I want to ask a big picture question first. It seems a lot of your previous books have the 1930s and early 40s as a backdrop. What interests you so much about that time period?
Yeah, I think there was a historian who wrote once about how he thought the 30s were the most creative scientifically and socially in American history. That's really contributed to the fascination for me. And then I think that just some of the subjects that I got interested in for other reasons tended to have this connection to the 1930s. My biography of Ernest Lawrence of Berkeley, he really remade particle physics in the 1930s. Hoover Dam obviously was a project, although it was conceived at the turn of the last century, it really came to reality in the 1930s. Then the New Deal obviously is an artifact of the 1930s, and I was interested in the New Deal for other reasons than simply the fact that it was the 1930s. So I think it's in a way coincidental, but nothing is ever completely coincidental.
Yeah,
So there's something there that attracts me to that period.
absolutely. I want to ask about the Hoover Dam first. I live in the Central Valley in Fresno, and so I've been watching the high-speed rail creep up the valley. What do you think, if any, are there lessons that you took away from your writing about the Hoover Dam about large infrastructure projects and why they're so hard to complete?
Yeah, look, Hoover Dam was built. Certainly, the construction era was an era when there was not much opposition. There certainly wasn't local opposition to the building of the dam. The population that we now have in that region is the result of the building of Hoover Dam. This was a period also when the United States was not really accustomed to doing big major infrastructure projects. So Hoover Dam was unique, and there was just not much standing in its way. The impetus for it came from Southern California. It came from the Imperial Valley, which needed the water and needed flood control. And there was nothing around Black Canyon or Boulder Canyon that really would have interfered with this project. Today, things are different. You have to sympathize, I think, with the designers and promoters of big infrastructure projects because they have to accommodate local interests and local concerns more than anybody thought they would have to do in the 1930s. I don't think there's anything wrong with that necessarily, but it's something that we have to acknowledge exists. We do in recent decades, certainly in the post-war years, we have come around to the idea that local residents and local interests really do need to be considered when we're talking about things that will change the landscape, certainly to the degree that Hoover Dam did. So I think this is a natural evolution of civilization in its way, and we have to deal with it. And I don't think there's anything really wrong or necessarily regrettable about the fact that it takes many years to accomplish what could have been done in 5 or 6 years, 80 years ago.
Yeah, just a mile and a half south from my house, there's a freeway called the 180 that cut through one of the most historic neighborhoods in Fresno, and some beautiful craftsman homes were lost, and it was done haphazardly at best. So I get that. And I get that it will always e be easier to build a solar farm in East Nevada than
Sure.
a rail line going through the middle of a metropolitan area. Can I ask you?
Exactly. I've also written about the fact that the high-speed rail, I mean, I wrote this several years ago, but at the time, and I think it's still true, is that big projects like that have a period in their arc where they're at great risk because it doesn't seem that they're progressing much, but the period in which they're really being first built is a period when local interests come to the fore, whether they have to surmount a lot of obstacles, and the end game is not really visible. And I think that's what's afflicted the high-speed rail
Yeah.
project for years.
My next question, I'm not only saying this because I'm an alumnus of San Francisco State, which is a kind of a brutalist masterpiece, and so I have a particular appreciation for concrete architecture, but do you think the Hoover Dam is beautiful?
I do think it's beautiful. And you may be aware that the architect, that is the architect of the outside of it, not of the inner workings, was the same architect who designed the Los Angeles Times building,
Oh, I did not
which
know that,
was,
actually.
yes, Gordon Crawford. And you can see the family resemblance between the design of the dam and the design of that building, which, by the way, we're no longer in that building. We've been moved to a more nondescript building down by the airport. But I used to, when I was giving talks about the Hoover Dam book, I used to post an image of the LA Times building and the dam under the headline, Separated at Birth, because they really do have this resemblance. And it's that machine era, machine architect. And by the way, the college that I went to had one of the great monuments of brutalist architectures, the Charles Dana building, which was designed by Paul Rudolph at Colgate University, and it's still there, and it is very brutal. But we loved it.
I love that one of the great movies of last year was The Brutalist. But
Oh,
anyway, in
wait.
any case, I want to ask you about Silicon Valley next. So you wrote a book, I think almost 25 years ago, Dealers of Lightning. How has your view on kind of founder mythology evolved since writing that book?
Yeah, what I try to tell people, and what I try to tell my colleagues who were writing about bro ethics out of Silicon Valley is that Silicon Valley hasn't changed that much in the way people like to think. They say, these guys are so rich. Where did they come from? It didn't used to be that way. But I think the error that people fall into is that Silicon Valley, almost from the beginning, was a pretty liberal place. And that's still true. The employee level workers at in the Silicon Valley high tech companies are very democratic in their leaning. The local politicians who get elected in that part of California are almost exclusively Democrats, and the entrepreneurs, the Musk, the Peter Thiel, the Zuckerbergs, and what have you, they're not very different from entrepreneurs of the past, entrepreneurs of the birth of Silicon Valley, entrepreneurs of technology going back even further, in that their attitude is, we're doing great things, we're going to change the world. If only the politicians will get out of our way. That's not new. These guys have more money than their forebears had, and they have tried to exercise their power more overtly and deliberately than their forebears did. But their general attitude about their relationship to regulation and their relationship to government more generally is not very different from what we've seen in the past.
Just with a veneer on top, a silicon veneer. Did you read Malcolm Harris's Palo Alto?
I did. I
What
did.
did you think
And I
about
know
that?
Malcolm. And
Yeah, what did you think
well,
about his book?
I thought it was good. I'm not sure I fully agreed with his thesis, but I thought he captured the era he was working about and the region he was working at very well.
Okay. Your book about Ernest Lawrence was fascinating to me. I've gotten little bits and pieces, particularly through the Oppenheimer biography and different components of it. It was nice to have it consolidated. I guess I want to ask you, does science, having written that book, do you think that science needs some kind of military urgency in order to innovate?
I think it ne necessarily needs military urgency. I think that the military aspect of the growth of big science really was an artifact of World War II, and Ernest Lawrence was well placed to exploit that, not only to his own advantage, but to the advantage of the University of California and to physics more generally.
That's another area, sorry to interrupt. That's another area where people don't quite understand the development of the UC system and the military industrial complex is so enmeshed that you can't really understand one without the other in some ways, in California at least.
That's true. And that was really a product of Ernest Lawrence's relationship with the military, relationship with General Groves, and his relationship with the foundations who were funding him. And then, of course, it defined his relationship with the University of California. But since the war, really, the federal government has played such an important role in the development of science, particularly basic science. And we've seen that really up until the present day, where for some inexplicable reason, this federal administration wants to be at war with science, even though science would basically, and scientists would basically help the administration get what it wants in terms of its international role. It's hard to understand, but really, since World War II, the relationship between science and scientists and big projects and the federal government has been fairly close.
So, of your previous books, which one do you think affected your understanding of California the most?
That's a good question. I would say probably Dealers of Lightning and Big Science, that's the biography of Lawrence, together really told me more about the character of California than in my others.
Okay, let's jump into your current book. I want to ask you about your research process to start. I talk to a variety of historians, and I find there's two tracks where you have some great volumes of history that represent a crystallization of knowledge, a career of learning a subject, and then putting that. I think about Continental Reckoning, which was a fantastic book that came out, and it's a culmination of a career. And then you have books that are kind of more acute research periods where it delving into a specific subject and getting lost in that subject. Which one of these is, I could see it go either way for you. Which one of these, what Golden State, which one is it for you?
I would say Golden State is not narrowly conceived. But in my process, I consulted works by historians that focused on incidents and periods fairly narrowly. But also, I consulted, as I said, Kevin Starr's books, Carrie McWilliams. But I tended to use them more as tip sheets. They would cite primary or secondary sources, and then I would go and find those sources and consult them myself. So they pointed me to things I determined I needed to know and helped me in that way. But there were works that were narrowly focused that were just incredibly valuable. Benjamin Madley's book, An American Genocide, which was just
It's a devastating read.
a devastating read, seminal work on that era of the genocide against the California tribes. There was a book that was published by the Sierra Club about John Muir and his effort to stop the Hetch Hetchy Valley from being flooded by San Francisco as a reservoir that really informed a lot of what I came to understand about Muir and his life and his approach. So it was a combination of books that were narrow, books that were broad. There was a book, a compilation of primary sources about the Spanish era that was really valuable. And it was really just an anthology of memoranda and letters and diary entries. And that was, I quoted from it, from those sources repeatedly in that part of the book.
You know, I'll have friends ask me sometimes, how do you know if you've become a history nerd? And I always say, it's because you're more excited about the bibliography than the prose. Let me ask you, I know you worked in some archives through this process. How do you approach an archive? They can be pretty intimidating places. If you have a great academic librarian that you work with, it can certainly help. How do you personally approach working in an archive?
It depends, as you said, it depends on the archive. Some are tougher to deal with than others. Some have more rules or stricter rules than others. When I would deal with the National Archives looking for documents, they are really strict. They want to make sure that the document you're looking at is on the table at all times, that your hands, both hands are on the table. I guess they've had experience with people trying to steal documents or alter documents, so they're strict. I've spent a lot of time at the Bancroft for my Lawrence book. Lawrence's papers are at the Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley. I spent a lot of time there, and I've spent a lot of time for some books at the Library of Congress. Oppenheimer's papers are at the Library of Congress, and when I was writing Big Science, I wanted to consult those as well. What's really interesting to me is how much of important archives is now accessible online. There are services that basically have digitized archives from major universities. One is HathiTrust. I don't know if you're familiar with them. It's a consortium of major universities: UC, Columbia, the University of Michigan, Harvard, Yale. And they basically allowed their archives to be digitized. I can sit at my desk and basically have access to most of the archives at all of these universities. It's just an amazing resource. And because I hold a library card from the Library of Congress, I can actually download old books from HathiTrust and put them in my archive. I've also been at archives where they don't seem to have any rules at all. I would walk in and I'd say, "Is it all right for me to photograph a document with my digital camera?" And the librarian would say, "Well, gee, I don't think we've had that question before, but sure, go ahead.
I
Use
actually
Flash
just
if you want."
I won't name the municipality that I'm about to throw under the bus here, but I actually walked into a local historical society's archive, and the librarian was quite literally smoking a cigarette at the desk inside. This was 15 years ago, but there's definitely a range. What was the most interesting source you found through this process that you unexpectedly happened upon and it changed your mind or was interesting for some intrinsic way?
I'd say the most interesting document I found was the transcript of testimony that was given to a congressional panel that came out to California in 1941 to decide what to do about Japanese residents in California. And this was a transcript by this individual that was one of the most remarkably racist documents that I had ever seen produced by a political leader. And that political leader was Earl Warren, who was the Attorney General of California at the time. And it basically taught me that about Warren's role in the incarceration and relocation of the Japanese, which was really incredibly influential. Without Warren, it's not clear that the relocation would have happened. He was just amazingly outspoken about the necessity of moving all the Japanese away from where they were in California and putting them in camps that were isolated. And as I said, his words were, now his feeling about the Japanese was so overtly racist that it really was hard to get over. And in fact, Warren, to the end of his life, would refuse to talk about his role, even when he was confronted by questioners. There was one point when he was at a meeting or an event at Bolt Hall, which was then the name of Berkeley's law school, and he was an alumnus of Bolt. And there were a number of Japanese American students in the audience, and they approached him and they said, "How can you defend your role?" And he would say, "I never look back. I don't look back at the past. What's done is done, and that's the way it is." And then he never really addressed it except in his memoirs, which were published posthumously, and may not his the regret that he expressed in his memoirs may not actually have been written by him, but by his editor, who was his son.
Whitewashing family history, a California tradition. I want to start by asking a few questions about the book now. I want to start by talking about this inflection point between the Spanish period and the American period. There's typically a lot of contrast with, treatments of indigenous people. And it seems like a lot of that is attributed to legal status or ways that indigenous people are approached over time by the Spanish. How distinct do you think that difference was between how the Spanish approached colonizing California versus how the United States approached it? And what do you attribute that difference to?
Our sense of the Spanish mission period has really evolved over the last 20 or 30 years, maybe even longer. And we've come to understand that the Spanish talked about their role in civilizing the tribes, but we know better now that this effort to civilize the tribes involved a lot of abuse, a lot of injury and death, and a lot of racial discrimination and bigotry. So I think we have a different sense of that now. And in terms of the national approach to the indigenous population, I think California isn't much different from the approach that the United States had across the plains, particularly. And it all has to do with what do you do about the indigenous tribes when they come into contact with settlers? In terms of American national history, it was the American push west across the plains that brought them into contact and really conflict with the tribes. And the sense that the tribes had to be moved out of the way was very strong. And we got the same sense here in California when the settlers arrived around the time prior to statehood and then statehood and then into the next decade or so. The settlers came, they saw great possibilities in cultivating the land around California. Certainly, when the gold rush started, the settlers came in as prospectors, as provisioners. The indigenous tribes were in their way. And you began to see this sense that the settlers thought that they were being abused by the Indians, and they asked the army. They asked the military to come and clear them away to produce a cordon sanitaire between them and the Indians. The Indians saw their habitats being denuded. They saw their livestock or their wildlife being essentially raided, and their response was to raid back for their own sustenance, and that became yet another incentive for these punitive expeditions that the settlers wanted the army to engage in. So
In
there's a
my
content.
conversation with Ben Madley, we talked about the kind of the looking for the excuse and then the dramatic overreaction and whether those excuses were phantoms to begin with.
I think the excuses were real, but the impetus for the excuses was definitely misstated. And there's a the idea that the Indian tribes got pacified is basically wrong. I think Madley makes the point that there came a point when there were massacres of Indian tribes that were engaged in by the U.S. military that were so horrific and reported as horrific events that periodically politicians and members of the public would think this is going to end that era. We're going to recognize that we're overreacting and that this is just too vicious. But I think, as Madley pointed out, the reason that the massacres eventually ebbed was that there were no more Indians to massacre. They had been moved out. The populations had just been reduced to the point where they were no longer a threat. They were no longer nearby. They had been removed from the territory that white Americans or European settlers wanted to settle and cultivate. And that's the time arc that we've just come to recognize, in part through Mathley's work.
Yeah, when I've taught classes on California history, I often refer to this approach as extraction through extinction. Just wipe them out, and we don't have to move them out, was the approach.
And that the earliest figures who were assigned the task of pacifying the Indians, of reaching treaties with them, of basically convincing locals and the tribes themselves that it was in their interest to be moved out, those figures would say quite overtly, they'd say to the Indians, look, your choice is relocation or obliteration. And we don't want to obliterate you. We don't want to extinguish you, but you're going to have to work with us to keep that from happening.
Another major point, and I often refer to this as the first golden spike that connected East to West, was the gold rush. There's been a lot of mythology around the gold rush about who came. There's this kind of archetype that we've created, this adventurous free spirit. How much of that is just retroactive kind of descriptions of what California is imagined to be placed back on these pioneers? Or do you think there is really an archetype of person that came west?
Yeah, there was an archetype that I think was accurate to describe the very first emigrants west for the gold rush. And these were, in fact, prospectors who probably made the most money or extracted the most wealth, but there was a very short period of time before the gold fields got industrialized and the lone prospector, the pioneer, became, as you said, an artifact, a mythical artifact, really. It wasn't very long. It wasn't more than a couple of years before the prospectors either had to associate with groups to basically get the gold, and then they became workers, laborers working for big companies that had industrialized the gold fields, that were using techniques that could not really be managed by lone prospectors or even small groups of prospectors. This was a major industry, and that's the way the gold rush evolved and eventually faded away.
When I talk to people about the 19th century in California, I think they imagine California as a continuous progressive experiment. And so then when I talk to them about Shiv Democrats in the 1850s, Chinese expulsion, Native American genocide, it seems like the story starts quite darkly in terms of California's history. Would you say that is there something true about California in those periods, or do you think this was a working out of the complicated diversity that was California, and then California came into fruition and to what it would become in the 20th century? How do you view that kind of dark period of the 19th century, like 1850 to 1882, or even 1900, you would say?
Yeah, the way I look at it is that, look, at the core of all of these evolutionary periods in California history is economics. The reason that the Chinese expulsion movement started, and this was a virus that started here in California and spread to the rest of the country, culminating in the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, is that the Chinese, after they had finished helping to build the first transcontinental railroad, they were still here and they moved into trades and they moved into farming in ways that brought them into conflict with the incumbents in those trades and the incumbent farmers. So basically, that period, that dark period, as you put it, had an economic basis. And the economics were that the settlers really wanted to be able to do whatever they wanted to do. And Chinese were in their way. Later, the Japanese were in their way. The way I talk about it when I give talks about Golden State is that I initially conceived the book and I pitched the book to my publishers as an inquiry into what California has taught the rest of this country and the world through its history. But as I delved into the research, I came to realize that there was a lot that California has taught the world and taught the country that maybe we pr would prefer the world and the country didn't know. And that includes the genocide of the 1860s, the anti-Chinese movement of the 1880s, 1870s and 1880s, the anti-Japanese movement of the turn of the last century, then right up to the 1940s, and so on. And that we can look back at California history as you said, this progressive continuum, but that's because we're in a progressive era today. But we can't forget that California has had very much non-progressive periods. We've given the country Nancy Pelosi and Kamala Harris and Jerry Brown and Gavin Newsom, but also Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. And Nixon and Reagan, as California politicians, were not outliers of their time. They reflected California values of their own eras, and they rode to the success by articulating and promoting those values. And they were conservative values. For Nixon, it was the Red Scare. For Reagan, it was the desire for small government, what have you. And they were not, as I said, they were not at odds with California voters of their time. The state has had its progressive periods and had very much the opposite. And you have to look at all of this as find the thread that ties them all together.
I have one question about Brown and Reagan here in a second, but I want to talk about Hiram Johnson first, or Hiram. I never know which one it is. Is it Hiram or
I
Hiram?
think of it as Hiram.
Hiram. Okay. So Hiram's such a fascinating character to me, created this kind of direct democracy in scare quotes that we have in California that's now been co-opted by various stakeholder groups, political action committees, whatever. But it almost mirrors his career in some way, as starting out as a progressive politician and then getting alienated from progressive goals and turning into a bit more conservative right-wing stalwart against some of the original ideas. What, given all of that, how should we think about Hiram Johnson's legacy? Like, he seems like such a mixed character. How do you think about it?
Hiram Johnson is really one of my favorite, maybe my favorite figure from California history. I just love the guy. He was this sort of truculent, pugilistic figure, as I wrote, and as I'm sure he was seldom photographed without his dukes up. And he started his political career. He started his public career really as the prosecutor of Schmitz and Abraham Rule in San Francisco, this incredibly corrupt administration in the Bay Area. And then he was pushed to run for governor. And his main plank, the main plank of his platform when he was running for governor was to get the Southern Pacific out of California politics. And it was obviously at a period when the Southern Pacific really was amazingly powerful. It dominated California politics. In fact, Hiram's father, Grove Johnson, was basically an acolyte of the Southern Pacific. Grove's son took a complete different standpoint. And his campaign against the Southern Pacific really was what brought him in contact with progressives of that era. And that included people who were pushing the idea of citizen democracy, of direct democracy. John Randolph Haynes got a recall and initiative written into the Los Angeles City Charter and then got together with Hiram to try to get that on a statewide basis. Now, as you say, that direct democracy has been co-opted recently. It's become a cat's paw of big business. But that was foreseen by many progressives of the era. Herbert Croly, who went on to be a co-founder of the New Republic, he would write and say, it's one thing to say that these new, that the initiative and the recall and what have you will dilute the influence of vested interests, but you may discover that it simply replaced those vested interests with new vested interests. And I think we can see that's happened in many ways as these great advances in political power have come to fruition on both sides.
A few months ago, I had a week off of work and I took some time to pore through Max Boot's new biography of Ronald Reagan, which was a fascinating read. I think it's as much a California history as it is a biography. And a number of years ago, I had read the kind of, I forget the name of the book or the author, that kind of the Browns of California. Who in your mind has transformed California more, Reagan as a governor or Jerry Brown as a governor?
I should start, by the way, by telling you that Max Boot was that I was the moderator of a panel at the most recent Los Angeles Book Fair, and Max Boot was one of my panelists.
Okay.
During that panel, I said to him, having read the book, so that I would have something to talk about as moderator, I said, "Max, my impression is that you think of Reagan as a fraud," and
To say the least.
He got a little insulted at that, and he said, "I didn't really think of him as a friend." I think that Reagan's influence was less on California as such than it was on national politics. I think Jerry Brown and his father had much greater influence on California. I think Pat Brown really was really one of the seminal governors, seminal influences on modern California
What about
that
this,
we've
Michael?
had.
Let me push you. Is the reaction to Reagan's governorship, did that create California as much as he did? You know what I'm saying? Like the response to the free speech movement and a lot of the things he tried to do as governor created kind of an opposition that's defined California as well. How do you think that's an accurate representation of influence as well?
The way I think of it, and the way I think I wrote about it, because I had access to the memoirs of Reagan's and oral histories of Reagan's California era aides and advisors, is that there was a reaction to Berkeley, disorder at Berkeley. It was tied to Vietnam War protests that Reagan wasn't really aware of until he started running, and then and he discovered that when he would go out and make speeches for his candidacy, his audiences would say, "What are you going to do about Berkeley?" So he seized on that and he ran against Berkeley, and that was also a way of his fighting back against Pat Brown, because Pat Brown was identified with the growth of the University of California, free university, the master plan for education. And Reagan got a sense that if you could run against that and depict that as fomenting disorder, you could win an election. And that's what happened. So I think Reagan's governorship was very much a reaction to what he saw on the ground rather than as a creator of it. But Brown had created the California that Reagan was running against. And then Jerry Brown, I think, was influential in bringing Californians back down to earth and saying, "Look, these are all the things we want to do and we know you want to do, but we have a crisis of resources and we're going to have to deal with that."
Yeah.
So
Well,
that's how I see that.
yeah. I want to conclude before we talk about book recommendations by asking a pretty loaded question, which is, what is the California dream and should we keep it alive?
The California dream to me is the dream of a diverse, equitable society that is also economically successful. And that the California dream is to show that you can have both aspects, and there will be conflicts and tension between them, but on the whole, they will work together. And I think the California dream is still with us. And I think I've mentioned in my book, and I mention when I give talks, that periodically, that in fact, it's an old It's a long tradition to question the California dream, and that right up to the last few years, there was an article by Connor Friesdorf in The Atlantic saying the California dream is dead. And we see that all the time. We see the same headline over and over again. I think California does sometimes get over its skis, but California has longer skis than most other states. And because of our size and our political heft and the wealth, the size of this economy, California is probably better suited than most other states of the union to actually address the problems that it has. It hasn't always done it successfully, and there are issues that we're trying to deal with that we don't seem to be actually getting very far with. But if any solutions to problems that California has that are going to be problems for the rest of the country, global warming, water shortages, and what have you, the chances are still great that they're more likely to come out of California than most other places.
Absolutely. We're going to close with book recommendations. What are a few books, either that you've used during research or were part of your process, or books that have been important to you over time that have a California flavor to them? What would you like to recommend to listeners?
I'd certainly recommend Kevin Starr's one volume history. It's really a good compilation of everything he learned as professor and historian and state librarian. I think Carrie McWilliams' works, there was so many of them, and he wrote books and he wrote biographies and he wrote studies for government agencies. I think Factories in the Field is a book that still should resonate with us, maybe more than even it used to. Southern California, book on Southern California, is a very revealing picture of the Southern California of that time. And I think his one volume book, California, the Great Exception, is really valuable for a picture of California at a time when it was really in ascendance. Ben Madley's book, An American Genocide, is indispensable to understand our relationship with the indigenous tribes. I think those are basically standouts.
Perfect. Last question, Michael. What are you working on next?
I'm trying to put together a new book proposal. It's
Is it in
not
the
quite,
1930s?
no, it's not. It's actually the 2020s.
Oh,
Or
okay.
actually, it will range from the Reagan era to the present day and look toward the future. But it's a work in progress. So I can't talk much about it because we haven't heard from publishers as to what they think about the proposal, but we'll be hearing soon.
Okay, perfect. Again, the title of the book is Golden State: The Making of California. Michael Hiltzik, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.